Welcome back to the show, everyone. Today, we're diving deep into a fascinating and frankly quite complex piece of news that has the political world buzzing. We're talking about former President Donald Trump and a potential Russia sanctions bill. Mrs. News, it's quite the headline, isn't it?
It certainly is, Mr. News. The report suggests that Trump, if he were to return to the White House, would actually be open to signing a bipartisan bill sanctioning Russia. Now, on the surface, that might sound like a significant shift for some who followed his past rhetoric regarding Russia. But, as always, there's a crucial caveat, isn't there?
Oh, absolutely. And that caveat is the entire story here. He'd support it, but only if he retains ultimate authority to decide when and how to implement those measures. This isn't coming directly from Trump, by the way, but from a White House official indicating his stance. So let's unpack this ultimate authority bit, because that seems to be the linchpin of everything.
Exactly. Ultimate authority is not just a throwaway phrase here. It speaks directly to the balance of power between the executive branch and Congress when it comes to foreign policy, and specifically, sanctions. Usually, when Congress passes a sanctions bill, it often includes very specific mandates, timelines, and conditions under which those sanctions must be applied or can be waived. It limits presidential discretion.
Right. So what Trump seems to be saying through this official is, I'll sign it, but don't tie my hands. I want the flexibility to use these sanctions as leverage, as a tool, rather than a rigid set of rules imposed by lawmakers. It's a classic executive power play, isn't it? A president wanting maximum flexibility.
Absolutely. And it's not just about flexibility. It's about control. It implies a desire to use sanctions as part of a broader, more fluid foreign policy strategy rather than a fixed punishment. If he has ultimate authority, he could theoretically implement them, ease them, or even lift them based on evolving geopolitical circumstances or, let's be frank, his own political calculus.
Which, you know, could be seen as a good thing by some, the agility to respond quickly to international events. But it could also be seen as dangerous by others, precisely because it removes a layer of congressional oversight and potentially gives one person immense power to shape crucial foreign policy without explicit checks and balances on every step.
Precisely. And let's remember the context here. This comes amidst ongoing debates in Congress about aid to Ukraine and the broader strategy towards Russia. There's a strong bipartisan push, even from some Republicans, for a tougher stance against Moscow. This statement, coming from a White House official, almost feels like a strategic move to potentially bridge that gap, or at least appear willing to.
It's very much a strategic maneuver. It allows him to say, look, I'm not soft on Russia, I'm willing to sanction them, while simultaneously asserting his vision of a strong presidency. It's almost like a have your cake and eat it too scenario for his political base and critics alike. He gets to look tough on Russia without losing any perceived executive control.
That's a great way to put it. And when we look at Trump's past presidency, his approach to foreign policy was often characterized by a preference for direct negotiation and a skepticism towards multilateral agreements and established international norms. Giving him ultimate authority over sanctions would align perfectly with that philosophy.
Remember the debates around his proposed summits with Putin, or even the America First doctrine, which prioritized U.S. interests above all else, often implying a unilateral approach? This ultimate authority clause feels like a direct extension of that worldview, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. It suggests that any tools, like sanctions, should be wielded directly by the president, much like a business leader, to achieve desired outcomes, rather than being constrained by the legislative process or international consensus. It's a very transactional view of foreign policy.
So then the question becomes, what does Congress do with this? If they pass a bill with tight restrictions, would Trump veto it, effectively blocking any new Russia sanctions? Or would they try to compromise and find a middle ground, perhaps offering some flexibility, but not ultimate authority?
That's the political tightrope they'd have to walk. Congress often wants to express its will through legislation, especially on matters of international importance. If they give a president carte blanche on sanctions, they essentially relinquish a significant part of their power. So it's a battle for institutional power as much as it is about policy towards Russia.
It truly is. And this isn't the first time we've seen this push and pull. Even prior administrations have had debates with Congress over the extent of executive power in foreign policy. But with Trump, it always feels a little more pronounced, a little more absolute in its demand for control.
That's fair to say. His approach tends to be less about nuanced diplomacy and more about direct assertions of power. So for a potential sanctions bill, ultimate authority isn't just a preference. It might be a non-negotiable condition for his signature.
Let's pivot a bit. What are the practical implications of giving a president ultimate authority over sanctions? Say, for instance, a situation where the geopolitical landscape shifts rapidly. A president with that power could, theoretically, lift sanctions almost instantly without having to go back to Congress for approval, good or bad.
Well, the good argument would be speed and responsiveness. In a crisis, you don't want to wait for a lengthy congressional debate to adjust your diplomatic or economic leverage. The bad argument, however, is precisely that lack of deliberative process. Sanctions are often complex, with wide-ranging economic and humanitarian impacts. Bypassing Congress removes a vital layer of debate and diverse perspectives that can lead to more considered policy.
And it could create uncertainty, couldn't it? For allies, for businesses, for the targeted country itself? If sanctions can be turned on and off like a light switch based on the whim of a single leader, it makes long-term planning incredibly difficult.
Absolutely. Consistency and predictability are key components of effective foreign policy, especially when dealing with economic statecraft like sanctions. If the world perceives that U.S. policy can pivot dramatically without institutional checks, it might erode trust and weaken the impact of those very sanctions.
So, this statement from the White House official, while seemingly a small detail, really opens up a Pandora's box of questions about how the U.S. would conduct its foreign policy towards Russia, and indeed the world, under a potential future Trump administration.
It does. It signals a potential return to a highly centralized, executive-driven foreign policy where the president's personal judgment and negotiating style take precedence over legislative mandates. And it forces Congress to consider how much power it's willing to cede, especially given the geopolitical stakes with Russia.
It also implicitly raises questions about the effectiveness of sanctions themselves. Many argue that sanctions, while a critical tool, often have mixed results. Some say they hurt ordinary citizens more than the regimes they target. Others believe they are essential for deterring aggression. Does granting ultimate authority make them more or less effective, in your opinion?
That's a fantastic point, Mr. News. The debate over sanctions' efficacy is perennial. Granting ultimate authority could make them more effective in the sense that they could be deployed or adjusted with speed and precision to achieve a specific, immediate diplomatic goal. If a president is negotiating directly, having that on-off switch could be powerful leverage.
So like a scalpel rather than a blunt instrument?
Precisely. However, the downside is that it could also lead to inconsistent application, undermining the long-term credibility and international cohesion often needed for sanctions to truly bite. If allies aren't confident in the U.S.'s consistent policy, they might be less willing to join in multilateral sanction regimes, which are typically far more impactful.
That's a critical distinction. Unilateral sanctions by the U.S. are powerful, but coordinated international sanctions are often devastating. If a president's ultimate authority makes it harder to build and maintain those coalitions, then the overall effectiveness could actually diminish, despite the perceived flexibility.
Exactly. And it also brings into question the domestic political implications. A president with ultimate authority might face less resistance in their foreign policy decisions, but they also bear full responsibility for the outcomes, good or bad, without the shared burden of a congressional mandate.
Which again, knowing Trump, is likely something he'd embrace. The idea of taking full responsibility, but also full credit. It fits his brand of leadership.
Indeed. It aligns with his "the buck stops with me" mentality, but also with a "I know best" approach to complex international relations. So, this isn't just about a Russia sanctions bill. It's a window into the potential operational style of a future administration.
So, moving forward, what should we be watching for? Clearly, this statement sets a marker. We'll need to see how Congress reacts, whether any proposed bills attempt to incorporate this ultimate authority clause, or if they dig in their heels.
Absolutely. Keep an eye on the language of any bipartisan sanctions bills that emerge. Will they try to give the president some leeway, perhaps a waiver authority, but not outright ultimate authority? Or will they present a more rigid framework, forcing a potential clash? It will be a fascinating negotiation, even if hypothetical for now.
And it reminds us that foreign policy isn't just about the actions taken, but about the mechanisms and powers used to take them. This ultimate authority clause is a prime example of the ongoing, often hidden, struggle for control over U.S. global influence.
Precisely. It's a foundational issue in constitutional law and international relations. How much power should one individual wield in matters of war and peace, trade and economic pressure? This specific statement from a White House official really brings that question to the forefront with direct relevance to current events.
It makes you wonder, if this were to pass with that authority, what would prevent a future president from demanding similar ultimate authority on other critical foreign policy tools? It could set quite a precedent.
Indeed, precedent is everything in constitutional matters. If Congress were to concede ultimate authority on Russia sanctions, it would be difficult to argue against it for other matters, say, sanctions on China or Iran, or even the deployment of troops without explicit congressional approval. It could fundamentally reshape the balance of power.
So, this isn't just a political soundbite, it's a constitutional and strategic chess move that could have long-lasting implications for how the United States operates on the global stage. It's certainly something we'll be keeping a close eye on.
Absolutely. It's a test of wills between the branches, and a clear signal of the kind of executive leadership we could anticipate, a truly defining condition to watch.
Well, Mrs. News, another incredible breakdown of a complex issue. Thank you for shedding light on the nuances of this ultimate authority clause.
My pleasure, Mr. News. Always a treat to discuss these crucial developments with you.
And that wraps up our discussion for today. Thank you all for tuning in and staying informed. We'll be back next time with more in-depth analysis of the stories shaping our world. Until then, take care.
Talking about UFO no more. Everybody's talking about release the files. Girl, come on down, don't be a duck pretending like you don't give a UFO no more, everybody's talking about release the files. Come on, Donald, don't be a duck pretending like you don't give a fuck.
School is always early. and churches every other Sunday. Now you think you're grown, you spread your wings and go. You got troubles that show. You explore the world on your own. So when you are searching for the latest news, baby, go inside your internet feed. There you'll find the truth. Let your provider deliver it for you. From all four corners, 100% approval rate. And I heard it is better all the time, Mr. News, World News, breaking news, romantic goose, articles of love from Mr. News.
Welcome, everyone, to the Daily Download. Today, we're diving deep into a story that's been making headlines in Arizona, and frankly, it really cuts to the heart of public trust and election integrity. We're talking about former Arizona State Senator Anthony Kern, who has now pleaded guilty to forging petition signatures.
It's a really significant development, isn't it? I mean, Kern, a former Republican lawmaker, has admitted guilt to one felony count of conspiracy. This isn't just a minor infraction. This is about the fundamental process of getting on the ballot in the first place, and it's something that frankly has serious ramifications for any public official, let alone one with his background.
Absolutely. For those unfamiliar, Anthony Kern has been a pretty prominent figure in Arizona politics for a while now. He's been a state representative, a state senator, and he's also widely known for his role in election denialism and even being involved as a fake elector during the 2020 election cycle. So this guilty plea adds another layer to his controversial public image.
It really does. And to think this all stems from his 2022 campaign for Maricopa County Supervisor. You'd think someone with that much political experience would understand the rigorous requirements, the absolute necessity of integrity when it comes to gathering signatures to even get your name on the ballot. This isn't just sloppy work. It's a deliberate act to circumvent the rules.
That's exactly it. The charges originally included conspiracy, forgery, and false impersonation. The fact that he's pleaded guilty to conspiracy, even if it's just one felony count, is still incredibly telling. It implies a coordinated effort, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. And the details that have come out are quite something. According to the investigation by the Arizona Attorney General's office, Kern, along with another individual named Robert Montgomery, allegedly fabricated signatures on Kern's nomination petitions. Montgomery, who was actually a former chief of staff for another state senator, Kelly Townsend, admitted to signing names on petitions provided by Kern. That's a pretty direct link, you know?
A very direct link. And it wasn't just a few names here and there. Montgomery apparently confessed to signing numerous names. This wasn't an isolated incident, it seems like, and Kern's role, according to the plea, was instrumental in that conspiracy. He provided the petitions, and he clearly knew what was happening.
It speaks volumes about what some individuals might be willing to do to try and gain or maintain power. The public expects, and indeed deserves, that candidates follow the rules, that the process is fair and transparent. When you have an elected official or someone seeking office engaging in this kind of fraudulent activity, it truly erodes that foundational trust.
It does. And let's talk about the ramifications here. The sentencing is set for July 12th. He could face probation or up to 2.5 years in prison. Now, the plea agreement does open the door for him to potentially avoid prison time, but the bigger picture for his political career is quite stark. A felony conviction of this nature means he cannot hold public office in Arizona for the rest of his life, and he can't even vote until his civil rights are restored.
That's a massive consequence. Someone who has been so deeply embedded in Arizona politics, who has championed certain causes, often around election integrity, ironically, now is forever barred from holding public office and can't even participate in the very process he supposedly sought to protect. The irony, I think, is not lost on many people.
The irony is palpable, truly, and it raises questions about the individuals who were circulating these petitions. There was another person, Christina Cortez, mentioned in the articles as witnessing some of the petition sheets. It really highlights how many people are involved in the petition gathering process and how vital it is that everyone involved upholds the highest standards of ethics.
Right. It's not just the candidate, it's the entire campaign machinery. Everyone has a role to play in ensuring that the signatures are legitimate, that the process is followed. Because without that, what are we really doing? We're undermining the very democratic principles that we claim to uphold.
And this whole situation takes on an even greater weight when you consider Kern's history. As we mentioned, his involvement in the fake elector scheme, his presence at the January 6th events in Washington, D.C., and his consistent rhetoric questioning the legitimacy of elections. It almost feels like a culmination of a certain disregard for electoral norms.
Just like a pattern, isn't it? A pattern of behavior that seems to prioritize personal gain or political ideology over the sanctity of the democratic process. And that's incredibly damaging, especially at a time when we're seeing so much division and distrust in our institutions. This kind of action only feeds into that cynicism.
It absolutely does. When people see public officials, particularly those who preach about election integrity, engaging in electoral fraud themselves, it creates a deep sense of disillusionment. It makes it harder for the average citizen to believe that the system is fair or that their vote truly matters.
And that's why these prosecutions, even when they result in plea deals, are so crucial. They send a clear message that there are consequences for undermining our democratic system. It's not just a slap on the wrist. There are real lasting impacts, both legally and for one's ability to participate in public life.
Exactly. The Arizona Attorney General's office handling this investigation and bringing these charges, it shows that there is a mechanism for accountability, even if it sometimes feels slow or protracted. This isn't just a political squabble. It's a criminal matter that directly impacts the foundation of our elections.
And it serves as a stark reminder for every candidate out there, regardless of their political stripe. The rules are there for a reason. They're designed to ensure fairness, transparency, and a level playing field. And if you try to cut corners, if you try to cheat the system, there are serious repercussions waiting for you.
Indeed, this case is far from over, with the sentencing coming up in July, but the guilty plea itself is a significant milestone. It's a moment of accountability for actions that directly threaten the integrity of our electoral process, and it's a story we'll continue to follow closely here on the Daily Download.
Absolutely. Because ultimately, the health of our democracy depends on everyone playing by the rules. And when they don't, it's vital that justice takes its course. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll catch you next time.
Thanks for tuning in. Stay informed, everyone.
Mr. News, please report. Hear my cry. Someone's out there stealing while the ink's still dry. My mailbox is a wreck, like it had a bar fight. Who's gonna fix this? Who's gonna make it right?
Oh, mailbox blues.
Got the mailbox blues.
Somebody took my
broken, the flag's torn down. Feel like a ghost town in this part of town. They snatched my hope, left me feeling hollow. I can't even trust the sunrise tomorrow. Strike again, they'll learn the cost. A thief might win,
but the trust is lost.
Oh,
oh.
"Good morning, Mrs. News." Or perhaps I should say, "Good morning, and are you ready for some football and some serious questions about public institutions?"
Mr. News, always with the dramatic entrance. But you know, this story we're diving into today, it absolutely warrants a dramatic entrance. It's got all the makings of a classic head-scratcher.
Indeed. We're talking about FIFA, the global football giant, reportedly using the esteemed John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts in Washington, D.C. for a World Cup event. And the kicker? They're getting the venue absolutely free of charge.
Free of charge. Let that sink in for a moment. For a multi-billion dollar organization like FIFA to use a federally subsidized institution, a living memorial to one of our presidents, without paying a dime for the space itself, it just feels off, doesn't it?
It certainly raises eyebrows. According to the report we're looking at from Ground.News, which cites a WUSA 9 investigation, a contract reveals this arrangement for a special event related to the 2026 World Cup preliminary draw, which is scheduled for 2024. Now, the Kennedy Center, for those who might not know, is not just any event space. It's a national cultural center, a monument, and it receives significant federal funding. Its mission is to promote the arts, education, and inspire. How does hosting a preliminary draw for a multi-billion dollar sports entity for free fit into that?
Exactly. When you think of the Kennedy Center, you think of world-class performances, educational programs, nurturing artistic talent. It's a place that belongs to the American people, supported by their tax dollars. And while it does rent out spaces, it typically charges market rates. So to suddenly waive those fees for FIFA, an organization whose net worth is in the billions and whose cash reserves are staggering, it's a hard pill to swallow for many, myself included.
And we're in dirty. Let's put some numbers on this, Mrs. News. FIFA, for context, reported revenue of nearly $7.6 billion between 2019 and 2022. They are absolutely swimming in money, from TV rights, sponsorships, ticketing, you name it. We're not talking about a struggling nonprofit here. We're talking about one of the wealthiest sports organizations on the planet.
And it makes you wonder about the why. What's the justification? Because I'm sure the Kennedy Center isn't just saying, "Oh, sure, come on in, FIFA, knock yourselves out, it's on us." There has to be some kind of rationale they're presenting.
They do have a rationale, and it's one we often hear in these kinds of arrangements: in-kind contributions and media exposure. The argument, presumably, is that the prestige of hosting FIFA, the global attention that comes with a World Cup event, even a preliminary draw, provides invaluable exposure for the Kennedy Center that far outweighs the rental cost. They're basically saying, "We'll trade free rent for the spotlight FIFA brings."
I hear that argument, Mr. News, and I understand the concept, but does it truly hold water in this specific instance? The Kennedy Center is already a globally recognized institution. Does it really need FIFA to put it on the map? And what kind of media exposure are we talking about? Is it truly converting into tangible benefits for the American public, for the arts, for their educational outreach, in a way that couldn't have been achieved by, you know, just having FIFA pay them?
It's a fair question. Let's consider the counterpoint. If FIFA is paying for catering, security, and other operational costs for this event, which the article states they are, why draw the line at the venue rental? Is the exposure really worth potentially millions of dollars in waived fees? Think about how much good that money could do for local artists, for struggling arts programs, for maintaining the very building itself.
Absolutely. That money could fund countless scholarships for aspiring artists, bring more free performances to the public, or support crucial maintenance for the facilities. It feels like a missed opportunity to leverage FIFA's incredible wealth for the public good, especially when the Kennedy Center's very existence relies on a blend of federal support and philanthropic donations.
And let's not forget the optics, Mrs. News. In an era where public trust in institutions is constantly scrutinized, a deal like this can quickly erode confidence. It looks like a classic case of a wealthy, powerful organization getting special treatment at a publicly funded venue, while smaller local organizations or even individual citizens would have to pay full price for similar usage.
That's exactly it. It creates a perception of unfairness. Imagine a local dance troupe or a community theater group trying to book the Kennedy Center for a special event. They'd face significant costs, and rightly so, because the venue has operating expenses. But then FIFA swoops in, and suddenly the rules are different. It sends a message, whether intended or not, that if you're big enough, you don't have to play by the same rules as everyone else.
In the context of DC as a host city for the 2026 World Cup is relevant here. The article confirms that Washington, D.C. will host World Cup matches. So in a way, this preliminary draw event in 2024 is part of the buildup. The city is preparing for the tournament. But even with that in mind, does it justify a free venue for FIFA? Isn't the benefit of hosting the games themselves enough?
It raises the question of what the city and its institutions are gaining versus what they're giving up. Yes, hosting the World Cup will bring economic benefits, tourism, and global visibility, but that's for the actual matches, the main event. This is a preliminary draw. It's an important administrative event for FIFA, sure, but it's not the spectacle itself that draws millions of visitors.
It begs the question, how often do these kinds of in-kind arrangements happen with major, wealthy organizations and publicly funded institutions? Is this an isolated incident, or is it a common practice that simply doesn't get reported until a vigilant news outlet digs up the contract?
That's a fantastic point, Mr. News. It highlights the need for transparency. When public funds are involved, even indirectly through a federally subsidized institution, the public has a right to know the details of these agreements. It's not about being anti-football or anti-Kennedy Center. It's about accountability and ensuring that public resources are used fairly and to the greatest benefit of the community they serve.
Let's also briefly touch on FIFA's track record. They've faced numerous controversies over the years, from corruption allegations to ethical concerns regarding host country selections. This history doesn't exactly build a reservoir of goodwill when they then seek to use public facilities for free. It just adds another layer of scrutiny to an already questionable deal.
Precisely. If an organization has a less than stellar reputation, there should be an even higher bar for justifying special treatment, especially when it involves public resources. It makes you wonder if the Kennedy Center weighed these reputational factors when signing off on the agreement, or perhaps the lure of global exposure was simply too strong to resist, regardless of FIFA's past.
And what about the impact on the local economy? While catering and other services for the event might be paid for by FIFA, the fundamental principle remains. The Kennedy Center could have charged FIFA, and that revenue could have circulated within D.C., supporting local arts, education, or even just adding to the Kennedy Center's own operating budget, reducing its reliance on federal funds.
It's not just about the money, though that's a significant part of it. It's also about the message. What message does it send to other institutions, to other wealthy organizations, to local businesses, when such a prominent public venue essentially gives away its space? Does it set a precedent that could be detrimental in the long run?
That's a scary thought. If every major international event or organization could argue for in-kind benefits or exposure in lieu of payment, then what's the financial sustainability plan for these federally funded institutions? They need revenue to operate, maintain their facilities, and fulfill their public missions.
Exactly. They rely on diverse funding streams, and rental income is a part of that. To essentially zero out one of those streams for a massively wealthy entity like FIFA just seems counterintuitive to the financial health and public mission of the Kennedy Center. It forces a conversation about values. What do we prioritize when we talk about our cultural institutions?
So looking ahead, Mrs. News, what do you think the public's reaction will be? This report is out now. Will there be pressure on the Kennedy Center to revisit this arrangement or perhaps clarify the full scope of in-kind benefits they believe they're receiving?
I certainly hope so. Public awareness is the first step towards accountability. I think people will want more details, more transparency. They'll want to understand why this specific deal was deemed acceptable, especially when a simple rental fee could have generated significant revenue for a beloved public institution. It's a teachable moment, I think, about how public-private partnerships, or in this case, public-wealthy organization partnerships, should truly benefit the public.
It's a delicate balance, trying to bring in high-profile events while also upholding the public trust and managing financial responsibilities. This FIFA Kennedy Center deal certainly ignites that conversation. It's one we'll be watching closely as the 2024 preliminary draw approaches.
Indeed, because at the end of the day, when a multi-billion dollar entity gets a free ride at a public institution, someone somewhere is ultimately paying for it, and it's usually the taxpayer, either directly or through foregone revenue that could have served serve the public in other ways.
A very salient point, Mrs. News. Thank you for dissecting this with me today. It's a story that truly makes you think about who benefits from these grand spectacles.
My pleasure, Mr. News, and thank you all for tuning in. We hope this discussion has given you some food for thought on how our public institutions navigate the world of big business and global events. We'll keep an eye on this one as it develops. Until next time, stay informed.
Welcome back to the podcast, everyone. We've got a really critical development to discuss today. The UN Security Council just adopted a U.S.-drafted resolution supporting a ceasefire proposal for Gaza, and it's already causing a ripple effect, isn't it, Mrs. News?
Absolutely, Mr. News. It's a huge moment, a really significant diplomatic push, but as always with this region, it's far from straightforward. We've seen an immediate and frankly quite nuanced reaction from Hamas, which is going to be the central point of our discussion today.
Right. So for those who might not be entirely up to speed, President Biden outlined this three-phase proposal back on May 31st. Can you quickly walk us through what those phases entail? Because I think understanding them is key to understanding the current impasse.
Of course. So phase one, which is where the immediate hope lies, calls for an immediate and full ceasefire. Crucially, it includes the withdrawal of Israeli forces from all populated areas of Gaza, the release of some hostages, specifically women, the elderly, and the wounded, in exchange for Palestinian prisoners, and a significant increase in humanitarian aid. That's the very first critical step.
And then, if that holds, we move into phase two, which is where things get even more ambitious, I'd say.
Exactly. Phase two envisions a permanent end to hostilities, the release of all remaining living hostages, and a full withdrawal of Israeli forces from Gaza. This is where the rubber really meets the road, you know? The permanent end to hostilities part is a massive sticking point, as we'll get into.
And finally, phase three, which feels almost like a long-term dream at this point, but it's essential for rebuilding.
That's right. Phase three is a major multi-year reconstruction plan for Gaza, which, frankly, is desperately needed given the destruction. It also includes the return of the remains of any deceased hostages. So you can see it's a comprehensive framework, but each step is contingent on the previous one.
So the UN Security Council vote, it passed 14-0 with Russia abstaining. That's a strong show of international support, isn't it? The U.S. in particular has been very clear, stating that Israel has accepted this plan and urging Hamas to do the same.
It is, Mr. News, and that 14-0 vote sends a powerful message. However, the situation on the ground and the rhetoric is much more complicated. The U.S. says Israel has accepted the plan, but then you hear Prime Minister Netanyahu saying Israel will continue the war until Hamas's capabilities are destroyed and all hostages are returned. It feels like a disconnect, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. It makes you wonder about the precise definitions being used, or perhaps the acceptance from Israel has certain caveats the U.S. isn't publicly emphasizing. But let's get to Hamas's reaction, because that's where the critical juncture is right now. They welcomed aspects, but also were critical of others. That's a very specific kind of rejection, isn't it?
It is. It's not a blanket no, which is important to note. They said they welcomed the resolution's call for a permanent ceasefire in Gaza, the complete withdrawal of Israeli forces, prisoner exchange, reconstruction, and the return of displaced persons. So, the broad goals resonate with them. But then, they immediately followed up with significant criticism.
And those criticisms, from what I understand, really boil down to a demand for guarantees. They want specific assurances, especially regarding the permanent ceasefire and the full withdrawal. It seems they're worried about previous ceasefires breaking down or Israel not fully adhering to commitments.
Precisely. They're demanding specific guarantees from the U.S. They're wary of a situation where Israel might agree to a temporary ceasefire, claim it's phase one, and then resume hostilities before phase two's permanent end is established. It's a matter of trust, or rather, a deep lack thereof, based on decades of conflict and broken promises from their perspective.
So it's not just a rejection of the plan itself, but a demand for a stronger commitment, a more ironclad assurance that the phases will lead to what they perceive as their core demands, a permanent end to the Israeli military presence in Gaza and an enduring ceasefire. They feel the current resolution, as it stands, falls short in those specific guarantees.
Exactly. They also emphasize their readiness to deal positively with any proposal that genuinely leads to a permanent ceasefire, full withdrawal, reconstruction, and prisoner exchange. So, they're not shutting the door entirely, but they're setting very clear conditions for opening it further.
And this is where the diplomatic tightrope walk becomes incredibly precarious. The U.S. and its allies are pushing this as an Israeli plan that Hamas needs to accept. But Hamas is saying, hold on, we need more than just words. We need actionable guarantees that this isn't just a pause, but a true end. And then you have Russia abstaining in the UNSC vote, citing a lack of clarity and no clear signal from Israel.
That Russian abstention is telling, isn't it? It highlights the perception that even with a strong UN vote, the ground truth, the actual commitment from all parties, is still murky. For Russia, it seems like the details, and crucially, Israel's concrete, unequivocal buy-in, just weren't there in the resolution's language.
It puts the ball squarely back in the court of the mediators, doesn't it? Qatar and Egypt have been instrumental in these negotiations. They're going to have to work overtime now to bridge these gaps, especially around the definitions of permanent ceasefire and full withdrawal and what guarantees can actually be offered.
Absolutely. It's not just about getting people to agree on words on paper, but ensuring those words translate into concrete, verifiable actions. Hamas's historical experience with truces and ceasefires means they're going to be extremely cautious. They've seen temporary pauses used by Israel to regroup, from their perspective, only to resume operations later.
And the domestic pressure on both sides can't be understated either. For Netanyahu, agreeing to a permanent ceasefire without completely eradicating Hamas, which was his stated war aim, could be politically devastating. And for Hamas, accepting anything less than a full, guaranteed withdrawal and an end to the siege could be seen as a betrayal by their more hardline elements.
Precisely. The internal political dynamics on both sides are just as crucial as the international pressure. You have the families of hostages in Israel pushing for their return at any cost, and then you have a significant portion of the Israeli population who want to see Hamas completely dismantled. On the Palestinian side, the suffering in Gaza is immense, and there's a desperate need for relief, but also a desire for dignity and an end to occupation.
It's a tangled web, truly. So what do you think is the immediate next step here? Is it more shuttle diplomacy, or are we looking at a period of continued stalemate, potentially with increased hostilities?
I think it's a mix. There will be intense diplomatic efforts behind the scenes, you know, trying to flesh out those guarantees Hamas is looking for. The U.S. will likely put more pressure on Israel to clarify its own commitment to the long-term aspects of the plan. But until those core demands, permanent ceasefire, full withdrawal, and verifiable assurances are met to Hamas's satisfaction, it's hard to see a quick breakthrough. Sadly, I think continued hostilities, or at least a very tense standoff, is a real possibility.
It feels like we're constantly in this cycle, doesn't it? A new proposal, a new international push, and then the core intractable issues just resurface. The scale of the humanitarian crisis in Gaza also adds an incredible urgency to all of this. It's not just about politics, it's about people surviving day to day.
Absolutely. The human cost is immense, and that's often lost in the geopolitical chess game. For the millions of Palestinians in Gaza, this resolution and Hamas's response directly impacts whether they'll see an end to the bombing, get enough food, or even start rebuilding their shattered lives. It's not abstract for them. It's everything.
So as we watch this unfold, the key points to monitor will be how those guarantees are addressed, whether Israel's acceptance of the plan becomes more explicit and unambiguous, and if Hamas feels its fundamental conditions for a lasting peace are being met. It's a very delicate moment.
Indeed, this resolution is a step, but it's clearly not the final word. The path to a genuine, lasting peace in Gaza remains incredibly challenging, filled with deep mistrust and fundamental disagreements. We'll be watching it closely. Thank you, Mr. News.
Thank you, Mrs. News, and thank you all for joining us for this crucial discussion. We'll continue to track these developments and bring you the latest insights. Stay safe, everyone, and we'll catch you next time.
I watched the evening news, and Mr. News said, I heard you can't catch COVID if you smoke a joint with your friend. Remember when you baby boomers used to puff and pass? Even with a face mask, just stop it. Smoke a joint by yourself. COVID is still waiting for you to share your blood with someone else. And smoke a joint by yourself. COVID is still waiting for you to share your blood with someone else. And the
face off quick dates. And we know the truth. And I can't believe it's true. I'm scared to leave my house. COVID is still waiting for you to share your blood with someone else. So stop it and smoke a joint by yourself. COVID is still waiting for you to share your blood with someone else.
Whatever time you're joining us, we've got a really serious and frankly quite unsettling story making waves across Australia. It's about something that's supposed to be a source of joy and creativity for our kids, but has instead become a source of major concern. Colored sand.
Unsettling is absolutely the right word, Mr. News. When you hear school closures, your mind immediately jumps to something like an extreme weather event, or perhaps a critical infrastructure failure. But for it to be something as insidious as asbestos, hidden in something as innocent as colored sand used in art classes, it's a gut punch.
Precisely. We're talking about multiple schools across New South Wales and Queensland, and potentially other states as well, being forced to shut their doors or at least issue urgent warnings and undergo extensive remediation, all because a product intended for children's activities was contaminated with asbestos.
And it's not just the immediate closures, is it? It's the ripple effect. The panic for parents suddenly having to find last-minute childcare, the disruption to learning, the fear that their child might have been exposed to something so dangerous. I mean, what kind of exposure are we talking about here?
No, so babe, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? The authorities, like SafeWork New South Wales, have been quick to point out that the immediate health risk from short-term exposure to this particular type of asbestos, tremolite asbestos, is generally considered low. However, that's small comfort to a parent whose child has been playing with it potentially for months.
Tremolite. Now, that's not one of the more commonly discussed forms of asbestos, like chrysotile or amosite. Does that make it more or less concerning? And where does it even come from?
It's certainly concerning. Tremolite is one of the amphibolae forms of asbestos, often found as a contaminant in other minerals. While all forms of asbestos are dangerous, tremolite is particularly fibrous and can splinter into very fine, sharp particles that, when inhaled, pose a significant health risk over time.
The problem here is that the colored sand, specifically a brand called Creative Sensations, was imported. And therein lies a massive part of the issue.
Shut up.
The import angle. So this wasn't something manufactured domestically where we might expect stricter controls. This came from overseas, bringing with it this hidden danger.
Exactly. The product was imported, and it appears the stringent checks we'd expect for something going into schools weren't sufficient, or perhaps weren't applied at all regarding this specific contaminant. It highlights a critical vulnerability in our supply chains, especially for products coming from regions where regulatory standards might differ or be less rigorously enforced.
It really does make you wonder, doesn't it? How many other products, seemingly innocuous, might be slipping through the cracks? We trust that what we buy for our children, especially for use in educational settings, is safe. This shatters that trust.
Absolutely. This isn't just about a few bags of sand. It's about consumer confidence, regulatory oversight, and the safety of our most vulnerable population. We've seen reports of the sand being used in classrooms, art projects, sand trays, places where kids are actively handling it, kicking it around, potentially inhaling dust. It's truly alarming.
And the fact that it's colored sand, I imagine that makes it even more appealing to children. It's vibrant, it's tactile, it's everything you'd want in an art material. What a betrayal of that innocent appeal.
A complete betrayal. And the cleanup effort, Mrs. News, is not just a quick sweep and vacuum. When asbestos is involved, we're talking about highly specialized, costly, and time-consuming remediation. Schools have to bring in licensed asbestos removalists, often with air monitoring, sealing off areas, and thorough decontamination. It's a huge logistical headache and a significant expense.
I can only imagine. And while these remediation efforts are underway, the schools are closed. That means even more disruption. What about the teachers? They're often the first line of defense, handling these materials daily. Have they been given clear guidance or support?
They've certainly been part of the advisory warnings. Teachers, administration staff, anyone who's handled these materials is understandably concerned. And it's not just schools either. There have been reports of other facilities, like the Treasury Wine Estate site, also being impacted because they too use products from the same supplier. It shows how widespread this issue could be.
So it's not isolated to a single type of institution or a specific use case. This product had a broader distribution. And what about the mental toll on everyone involved? The anxiety for parents, the stress for school staff, the uncertainty for the children. That's a significant, if less tangible, cost.
Absolutely. The psychological impact is profound. Australia, of course, has a very painful history with asbestos. Generations remember the devastating health effects, the diagnoses of mesothelioma and asbestosis decades after exposure. So for this to resurface, especially in children's products, it triggers a deep-seated national trauma.
That's a crucial point, Mr. News. Our nation's history with asbestos makes this particularly resonant and terrifying. We've spent decades trying to eradicate it, to make our environment safe, and now this, it feels like a step back.
It really does, and it forces us to ask tough questions about how we ensure the safety of imported goods. Are our customs inspections rigorous enough? Are suppliers being held accountable? Is there a need for more robust testing regimes for materials used in schools and childcare facilities?
These aren't just rhetorical questions either. This incident demands a thorough investigation into the entire supply chain, from the point of origin through import, distribution, and ultimately to how it ended up in our classrooms. We need to prevent this from ever happening again.
Agreed. The Australian Border Force, alongside state regulators, will undoubtedly be under pressure to review and strengthen their processes. This isn't just about a supplier's negligence. It's about systemic checks and balances.
And for parents who might be listening, what's the immediate advice if they had this particular brand of sand at home? What should they do?
The advice is clear and urgent. If you have Creative Sensations colored sand at home, do not open it. Do not use it, and certainly do not discard it in your regular household waste. Contact your local council or relevant state authority, like SafeWork, for guidance on safe disposal. They will have protocols for handling potentially contaminated materials.
That's really important. We don't want people inadvertently spreading the contamination or exposing themselves further. And what about the kids who've already been exposed? Are there any medical monitoring programs being discussed?
At this stage, the official line remains that the risk from short-term exposure is low. However, given Australia's history, I wouldn't be surprised if there's significant public pressure for some form of long-term health registry or monitoring, especially for those with prolonged or repeated contact. It's a challenging area because asbestos-related diseases often have a very long latency period, sometimes decades.
That's exactly what makes it so terrifying. The idea that something seemingly seemingly harmless today could have devastating consequences far down the line. It's a silent threat.
Indeed, and it underscores the need for extreme caution when dealing with asbestos in any form. Even microscopic fibers can be dangerous. This incident serves as a stark reminder that while we've made huge strides in banning and removing asbestos, we must remain vigilant against its re-entry into our lives through unexpected avenues.
Vigilance, absolutely. And holding those accountable. This isn't just an accident, it's a failure somewhere along the line that has jeopardized the health and safety of our children. We need answers, and we need action.
Strongly agree. The focus now is on rapid remediation, supporting affected families and schools, and a thorough investigation to ensure such a lapse never occurs again. It's a wake-up call, and hopefully, one that leads to lasting change in how we protect our children from imported dangers.
Well, let's hope so, because our children's safety, their future, it's paramount. Thank you, Mr. News, for bringing us up to speed on this incredibly important and concerning story.
My pleasure, Mrs. News. And thank you to our listeners for staying informed on this critical issue. We'll continue to follow this story closely and bring you updates as they unfold. Stay safe, everyone.
Next time I fall, I let the wind decide. the sunlight into my head, where shadows used to make their bed. A broken clock still chimes, they say, but I'll keep spending time instead. Cracks a window,
every fall's a climb.
Paint my world in color,
no need to rewind,
no need to rewind.
Saturate my mind,
fill it up,
don't let it drain.
Even in the chaos,
hey, I'll dance in the rain, yeah.
Saturate my mind,
flood it bright,
keep it alive,
keep it alive.
No storm can drown me,
I'll always survive.
Clouds in the sky, the ink of hope won't ever dry.
Ah, even when
the world whispers a lie,
ah,
I'm a tune. Let the doubt pass by. Every crack's a window,
every fall's a climb.
I paint my walls in color,
only color girl.
No need to rewind.
Saturate my mind.
Articles of love by Mr. News.